Coming at you hot with episode 482. You're listening to the Flip Empire Show.
Welcome to the Flip Empire Show, bringing you the interviews, strategies, and insights for smart real estate investors. Prepare to dive into the minds of real estate's heavy hitters and gain the cutting-edge expertise you need to scale and grow your real estate empire. Your success and freedom starts now with your host, Alex Pardo.
Welcome back to the show, my friends. This is Alex Pardo, and this is we're going to be covering round four and round five of the most recent real estate investing heavyweights debate, storage or self-storage versus mobile home parks. I really want to, if you guys haven't tuned into the show for a while, tis, my friends. Now I'm messing with you. But if you haven't tuned in, I encourage you to check out episode 480. Episode 481, because what I have been doing for the last couple of Flip Empire shows is carving out certain sections of this debate, which was an effort to raise charity, which we succeeded between the two different debates that I've done. We have raised, thanks to the experts we've had on the show, thanks to the community and everybody who's participated and watched and engaged in these debates and in these Facebook Lives, we've raised almost $11,000. To the We Are Graces, for the We Are Graces charity, which is phenomenal because this charity helps impoverished children and families in Antigua, Guatemala. And so I really want to encourage you, if you haven't listened to episode 480 and 481, and now episode 482 is the continuation. So this debate was broken up into five rounds plus a bonus round. So what you're about to hear now is round four and round five. In round four, the guys, that being Scott Myers and Mike Wagner on the self-storage side versus Kevin Bupp and Ryan Norris on the mobile home park side, they debated which was the superior asset class when it came to construction and when it came to round five was management and operations. So in episode 482 here, you're going to hear the debate of round four and round five. So I'm excited for you guys to check this out. And if you haven't already, make sure you head over to reidebate.com so that you guys can access all the valuable resources our experts decided to give away and to incentivize you to make a donation, even if it's a dollar. So reidebate.com is where you can access all those resources and make a donation and vote who you think won the debate. So check it out and let's dive into rounds four and five here, construction and management slash operations, which is a superior asset class. I think mobile home park is going to kick us off here when it comes to the superior asset class. Now, again, Ryan, I know this is probably not your favorite when we're talking about construction here. We'll do construction. And then the fifth and final round is going to be management slash operation. So for this one, let's keep it on construction. You guys got 5 minutes.
Yeah, sure. Look, everything that that Mike said earlier is absolutely true. We see less than five mobile home parks get developed per year. So, for example, I just interviewed Ryan Gibson of Spartan Investments on my podcast, Mobile Home Parks in Real Life is my podcast. And he discussed what it took to develop one. And as soon as he finally barely like House of Cards did and got it through the city council, as soon as he got it, they actually created a piece of legislation banning that municipality from building any new ones. It's tough. There's absolutely no sugarcoating that it is really difficult to build new. And a lot of times, even just infilling or developing out new pads on something that you're even zoned with is a huge pain in the butt. However, I will say there are also lots of ways you can build ancillary income through laundry, sheds, self-storage, RVs, vending machines. There are also construction loans and stuff like that you can get to develop out some things. So there are ways that you can actually go in there and build things and develop stuff out. It's just really hard. And because that's generally speaking been a huge advantage about mobile home parks is that you have a limited supply and a seemingly unlimited demand, and you're 10 plus years ahead of the game. There is a ton of money to be made in this space. At the same time, build communities, make places better, have a strong why, and make a bunch of money in the same, all in the same vein. And just to hit you with some data from Williams Research Equity, the biggest Achilles heel from my perspective about mobile home parks has been CapEx. Right. So in other words, you don't own the homes, you just own the dirt and the infrastructure. Well, you know, you have to repipe something and it crushes you. Well, on the whole, from a macro standpoint, about 3.5% of the gross revenue on the whole for mobile home parks goes to CapEx, which is actually the lowest of any asset class, which is lower than the 4.7% annual revenue of self-storage. So there's actually less CapEx going on. So in other words, once you have these things stabled, once you're not chasing after heavy value add stuff like I am, yeah, we're not building any new, but hey, get in the game, get in the game now. Don't wait. We're well behind, but that's just more room for you to get in, create legacy wealth, and do it with nothing like me. No money, no experience, no network. Kevin, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I always look at the challenge to build new mobile home parks as a benefit to our industry, right? Like, again, it goes back to the supply-demand imbalance that exists in our space. And, you know, these regulatory restrictions that these municipalities put in place, it only benefits us from the today standpoint and also future standpoint. Because, again, self-storage anywhere that you live, the folks that are tuning in watching us right now, I guarantee within a 5-mile radius, there's probably at least two self-storage developments that are coming out of the ground. I see that as a huge risk, right? I mean, we all know that the real estate market goes through different cycles. These different iterations of cycles ultimately end up in a situation where a lot of times there's going to be oversupply, whether it be apartments, whether it be single family homes, whether it be self-storage. The oversupply is what typically will crush a particular asset class. And I see that as being a huge risk with self-storage. I mean, there's just really no controls in place to keep one of the larger operators from coming in and absolutely just crushing the little guy, building larger state-of-the-art facilities, putting more dollars behind their ad spend budget to basically crush the smaller operators that are in that space. And as far as mobile home parks as well on the construction side, one of the big benefits that exists in our space is when we're buying a mobile home park, we're typically just underwriting that mobile home park on the total number of existing lots that have occupied paying tenants on them. And very often what you'll find in the mobile home park space is that if you've got a 100-space mobile home park, very rarely are 100 of those lots occupied. In addition to that, a lot of times there's additional land, as Ryan had mentioned, that you could expand upon. But back to the point of those vacant lots, most of the time we're paying little to no dollars for those additional vacant lots that already have infrastructure in place. And so it's very easy upside, very, very easy to add, double, triple the value to any mobile home community if you're buying it based on the existing income that's in place and then have empty lots to infill. So huge benefits there.
You're good. 8 seconds. So we'll kick it over to the storage guys.
So, we're
talking construction here. So superior asset class self-storage. What are your thoughts?
Yes, it is. You want me to go on?
Please. that was a question, by the way. I remain neutral. Okay. That was a question, but go ahead.
You're just handing it to us. So, this is my third recession that I've been through and second being in self-storage. And so when Lehman Brothers fell last time out, banking shut down, the faucet was shut off on commercial finance and especially speculative, meaning development. Banks, they'll look at existing asset classes, any type of real estate, historical financials, show me what it's done for the past 5 years. I can lend on that maybe. Come in, Mike and I walk into the bank's office and say, hey, we got this piece of dirt. We're going to put self-storage facilities on it and it's going to produce X amount of income, in 2 years. They're going to say, well, we're not doing that right now. We're going to wait. So the good news is that as we come out of that recession, the demand, as we know, self-storage is better during a recession because of people are downsizing, businesses are downsizing. So we have this huge pent-up demand for self-storage and the financing was shut down. Well, then all of a sudden, 3 or 4 years later, 11, 12, we started constructing self-storage again. And at a time when occupancy was in the mid-90s. We still have not caught up. There are areas that are close to equilibrium, but we are not at the place right now where industry-wide, we're at 91% occupancy nationwide. And in self-storage, and in most commercial asset classes, but in self-storage, at 85% occupancy is when you're reaching equilibrium, meaning at a facility, meaning that I'm going to be out of some 5x10s or some 10x10s. I may have to move them in somewhere else, but at 85%, we're looking to expand. And so as an industry, we're at 91%. So these folks are full, they got waiting lists, and these are in the top 100 metropolitan statistical areas. And so to Kevin's point, and I know it's not a rebuttal, but you know, we everybody's always scared that what happens if the big guys come in and do this and squeeze out the little guy? Well, you know, the big guys, and we've got 2.2 million square feet of self-storage. We've got 40 facilities located all across the country, 13,000 doors, and 80% of all those are new development in the past several years. We've got six coming out of the ground right now. We don't do it for kicks. We don't do it for fun. The days of build it and hope they come are long gone. You know, we do feasibility studies. We hire consultants. We have software. We're boots on the ground. We know what's going on in the market. We're not going to put a facility in that in an area at our market that is oversupplied, nor is anybody else going to come in and see the, you know, whether we are a little guy or anybody else and say, wow, this market is oversupplied by 7 square feet per capita. Let's go throw a facility in anyways and just see if it works. And we'll take a chance and we'll lower rates to the floor and devalue our own facility and put everybody else out of business and drive the entire market down along with it, including the value of our facility. So That's not realistic, and I'm being facetious, Kevin. But you know what I'm getting. So that's not a big a risk because everybody's going to do this. Look at the same data, and if it's oversupplied, they're going to move 5 miles down the road and look at something else. So I think that's about all I think I wanted to hit on that piece. So Mike, I'll go ahead and turn over to you.
Yeah, and I'll just speak to the other side again from personal experience, what I've seen in the construction side. I'm going to tell you, I bought my first facility in 2011 for $330,000, $40,000 out of my own pocket that I extracted out of some duplexes. So getting in as a small investor, whole lot easier because our asset class doesn't start at a million on up. Now, that doesn't mean the profits are any smaller, though. Over the course of several years, I improved that facility. I tripled it in size. So I added 20,000 square feet to it. I had never built a doghouse before I took on that construction project. I had no business doing it. But the thing is, you have three or four tradesmen. You got somebody to move some dirt and lay some concrete. You got a metal building that shows up on a truck and they put it together in 4 days. Start to finish, it can literally be 2 to 3 weeks, right? And so clearly that shows how an idiot like myself at the time could do it, how quickly it can come together. And let's now talk about how profitable is it, right? I sold that property just a couple years after I finished the expansion. I sold it for $60 a square foot. My cost to build was $20 a square foot. So I tripled the money on a construction project that took 3 weeks per phase, right? You can't do that in mobile home parks. You're fighting City Hall, right? You're building on a house of cards, I think were the words that Ryan, my good man, used. And it just can't be done. In storage, it's easy. I did the same thing. That wasn't a fluke. I did it at another property. And I kid you not, talking about fighting City Hall, I got approvals to double, almost double, from 15,000 to 24,000 square feet. So not quite double. The size of a facility and build out with a site plan that I bought from www.mysiteplan.com for $129. Tell me when you've done that with a mobile home park, my friends. We're good.
All right, gentlemen. Ryan, Kevin, you guys got 2.5 minutes for anything you want to rebut.
Yeah, my very first mobile home park, still own it today. We're actually in contract to sell it. And so I want to make sure that everyone knows that it is very accessible for the smaller investor. I paid $200,000 for that mobile home park, a 34 space park in Atlanta, Georgia. We've owned it since 2012, in contract to sell that property right now as we speak for $1.25 million. I made my money back on that deal from cash flow in just 2.5 years, pure cash flow, got my original investment back. And so you guys can do the real quick math there as far as the total return. I mean, it's infinite. And so again, just I want to speak to the opportunity for the smaller folks to get into this business. And I mean, when I met Ryan years back, he was that guy. He was that individual that was entering into the space with very little money. There's a ton of opportunity there for that smaller guy. Ryan is proof in the pudding. I mean, literally that opportunity still exists. They still exist today to make big dollars in our space.
Yeah, I want to second that. Mike, I didn't know that about you. I had $30,000 to start out too, and I had 60 in student loan debt. So negative. it comes down to this: if you want to look at the data, if you can get those seriously compressed cap rates, if you can increase annual yield just by 2 to 3%, you can increase the property's value by as much as 50% in this space. 10 of the 17 mobile home parks that I will have bought, because I'm closing on one today, were bought sub $1 million. And arguably, because in my personal opinion, it doesn't matter what someone thinks it's worth. It's not until someone shows up and writes a check that you really truly know what something is worth. I don't think there's a single property in my portfolio that is worth less than $1 million right now. So, look, I mentioned earlier, every dollar I put in becomes $4 when stable. Not to mention, I'm hitting a serious cash-on-cash return. All of this by literally quitting my job, moving into a mobile home park, making massive sacrifices to do it. And the only reason why I wanted to do that is because I wanted to grow bigger and faster. If I just wanted to take my $30,000 and buy one and then slowly grow, I could have done it. But I hated corporate America. I was stuck. I wanted to do something bigger, better, and help people along the way. And so my journey took me that direction. And Kevin, as he mentioned earlier, was one of those people who helped me early on. There's a lot of great people in the space like Kevin and I who are willing to help you just because. So mobile home parks, let's go.
Ryan, I forgot you lived in a mobile home park.
It was the one right by that one you're talking about in Lovejoy.
I know.
All right. Mike, Scott, why don't you put a bow when it comes to, to construction here.
Yeah, to start my rebuttal, Ryan, my favorite thing about you now is, dude, that you moved into a mobile home park to make your dreams come true. For everybody listening, y'all got to take some of that medicine and do it.
Yeah.
That's awesome, brother.
Thanks.
That being said, I'm still going to pick both of you guys apart on some of the rebuttal here. Ryan, I think it was you that mentioned the CapEx, needing a higher CapEx in storage versus mobile home parks. And I'm going to be honest and say that may very well be true. I don't know. Because I'm not focused on the little battles. I'm all about the war. And the war is income to expenses. CapEx is one expense. When you add up all the expenses for each of the two industries, the income to expense ratio in storage is less than in mobile home parks. So maybe for CapEx, that's the one where we're a little higher. But who cares? We're looking at the end of the day. And income to expense comes out on the side of storage. The other thing, I know, Kevin, you mentioned, and a very valid point, and I love it. And I want to be clear, guys. I think we all know this. Making money in either of these two asset classes is 100% possible and doable. They're both great. It's just about which one's more efficient. And Kevin talked about buying a park with vacant units. Well, we do the exact same thing in storage. Scott could tell you. We don't buy the empty units. We buy the income of the full units. And so all of the value add by adding pads in a mobile home park is available to us in storage units in the same or greater proportions. The difference being we don't have to fight City Hall to get a new home put on there. We don't have to unclog the toilets if there is a home there. We just sweep out the unit, hit the button on the internet, puts our website live, and people start moving in and moving out while we're sleeping. The fact that there's more turnover in storage means nothing because we're not involved in it. People move out and they move in 24 to 48 hours later without us having been involved. We'll talk more about that in the next round. Scott, excuse me, I want to leave the last 45 to you if you have anything.
Yeah, and it was really about the same. Interestingly enough, Mike, I wrote down the same things that Ryan and Doa mentioned about the CapEx, and I was going the same place with expense ratios. 40% is the average income to expense ratio in mobile home parks, and it's 31 in self storage, so it's actually less. So when we talk about getting into the nuts and bolts of it in terms of CapEx. Well, we do have moving parts and we got buildings where you have pads and then, but your expenses are higher because when somebody leaves and they've got that shell of whatever that mobile home, that trailer, you've got to haul it away. And so there's an expense involved in that. But when it comes to let me take a step back, Alex, and let's just touch on this. We're all educators here. The point that I want to make clear is maybe a little different direction here is the beautiful thing about commercial real estate. And when we're buying a mobile home park or a self-storage facility, especially what we're looking at now and in the beginning is we try to buy everything value adds. So we're trying to buy an existing facility that has extra land. We have buildings on 4 acres and it's a 5-acre parcel. Kevin and Ryan are looking at a mobile home park that it's got pads on 4 of those 5 acres, and they can expand when they fill them up. And, you know, since we're financing it and doing our evaluations based on the NOI, the net operating income in place right then, it means that we had an acre for free. You know, use whatever example you want. And that's how we created the millions in this business of ours in the very beginning, which then catapulted us into getting into developments and bigger pieces. So I guess for everybody out there, you know, always be looking for value add, looking for ways to be able to create value when you close on that facility or that mobile home park in the beginning. And for gosh sakes, please get some help, get some mentoring, get some coaching, and understand the underwriting and the financials before you go out and make a decision on any one of these asset classes, because commercial is different, especially when your folks are coming up from single family and you're looking at a valuation based on an appraisal versus an NOI. There's an art and a science to that, and it takes a lot of years to really master it. And we're always still learning, but it still takes months before you really can wrap your head around it and move from that space. So I just want to make sure that everybody's clear that it's an incredible opportunity when you get into commercial real estate to have that power, but also it can work against you if you don't know what you're doing. So please make sure you have a mentor, somebody come alongside of you and help you underwrite either asset class that you're going to invest in.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you sharing that, Scott. And we went over time, but I think that's a very neutral and fair point that everybody would double down on. You know, regardless of what you do, whether it's commercial or whether it's single family, get educated, invest in yourself, align yourself with the right people that can help you, because especially in commercial, you know, I'm sure you guys will agree, one big mistake can really hurt you if you don't know what you're doing. So make sure that you have a coach, a mentor, a mastermind group. Just align yourself with the right people that have been there, done that. So appreciate you sharing that. I think it's a fair point, regardless of what asset class we're talking about. So having said that, we are going to wrap up. Actually, we got a bonus round, so we're not quite ready to wrap up the debate. But round 5 here, we're going to be focused on management and operations. Okay, so storage. You guys are going to kick us off. Self-storage. Scott or Mike, 5 minutes. Give us your best as to why you feel self-storage is superior, better, whatever you want to call it, when it comes to the management and the operation side of the business.
Yeah, I'm going to do my best to sneak in, Scott and I are, to sneak all these advantages in under 5 minutes. But this is really where the rubber meets the road and where storage emerges as the clear-cut winner. And what it comes down to, I think the overarching umbrella here is that storage operators don't have to rely on a very unpredictable resource known as people. No offense to any of us, we're all that. But there is an unpredictability within us that causes problems within every real estate investing operation in the world. And so it's not that we don't have to rely on people to some extent, but what we want to look at is how mission critical are the tasks that we rely on our people to do. And storage just has the opportunity to automate far more than you can in mobile home parks. And the things that are left for people to do are not mission critical, right? They're sweeping units and they're cutting locks. It's very low level manual tasks. It's not judgment and essential soft skills like figuring out whether or not somebody is credit worthy or has the right character to move into our park. And so for that reason, storage starts to take a lead. But the other thing is we're not dealing with habitational real estate. So from an operation standpoint, when someone goes delinquent, we're talking about getting them out and getting that unit re-rented in a matter of weeks from when they default. Whereas if you've ever experienced evictions or foreclosures, you know we're not talking about weeks. We're talking about many, many months and even into years sometimes in the worst cases. So again, that adds to income, the storage's ability to keep income to expenses so low. The other thing I can tell you is Ryan mentioned ancillary income. Funny enough, he mentioned it as a mobile home park operator. He mentioned using storage as ancillary income, which I found very interesting. We do the same thing, except storage operators stay within our realm of storage because that's the best place to be. We add tenant insurance and admin fees, even though there's not really any administration. We get paid for nothing because the computer does all of it by itself. People move in and move out literally on their phone in our parking lots without ever talking to us or interacting with us in any way. And so from an operations standpoint, storage is the clear front runner here. I'll just share personally, I run currently only 2. Again, I'm a small volume investor. It's been as many as 5 facilities, and it takes me approximately 1 to 2 hours per week to manage those properties for the tasks I do, mostly done from my phone or email, just texting, handling the occasional thing that needs to be handled. But 1 to 2 hours a week to generate all the money that my family needs to pay all our bills and live on the road for 6 months a year. So it's not that storage is, it's not only that storage is better at making money, but it's an easier way to make money. So Scott, I'll kick the rest of the time over to you, my man.
Sure. That's why we have a lower income to expense ratio, because the highest line item expense in any business is payroll. And, when we can operate and we have 80% of our rentals come from this, 80% in our industry of our rentals come from this. We have a website that is responsive, which means that it responds to whether somebody's on their laptop, an iPad, or a phone, and allows them to not only reserve a unit if they want to, but they can rent a unit and pay rent online. We have several of our facilities that are unmanned. This is a low labor intensive type transaction. You know, we can gather all the data that we need to, and feel safe enough to move somebody in, because like Mike said, we don't have to interview this person. And also, by the same token, we know that it's typically mom is the person in the household that is tasked with getting this storage unit. And so what she wants to do is, it's a commodity for her. It's something to check off her list. And if she can go to a website and see a picture of our facility, multiple pictures of our facility on the website, and she can see the ways to move in, that it's clean, it's safe, it's secure, it's well lit, the pricing and everything is there, and she clicks some buttons, that's one less thing for her to do during the day. She's not looking at school systems and neighbors and anything else. She needs a box to store her husband's junk in, and she wants to check this off her list. And the transaction is no more intensive than basically going to a Redbox rental. And we're secure. We got their credit card. You know, it's their stuff. If they don't pay, we lock them out and then we sell their stuff off. So we don't need to go through all of those other management intensive types of duties and tasks that a manager would have at a habitational type real estate. Mike also touched on the ancillary income streams. There's over 40 ancillary income streams or profit centers we can add in a self-storage facility to boost the NOI with very little to no investment on our part that we can add to a facility depending upon where it's at, from record storage to even propane. If you have a large boat and RV lot, we have those filling stations that have kiosk in it, so we don't have to mess with those. We have vending machines. Just many ways to increase the income. And then at the end of the day, once again, we don't have the habitational laws. We just have lien laws that protect us. They don't pay. We lock them out and sell their stuff.
Kevin, Ryan, what do you guys think?
You want to kick us off, buddy?
Yeah, sure. I think it's this concept of can be versus is. So, like, Mike, that is so cool. And I didn't know a lot of that, what you said. And I'd love to connect offline about more about what you guys do. I think that's wicked cool. And vice versa. Most of my business is automated as well. You have to have a human review the application. You just do. You just do. Humanity goes so much more beyond a credit score or a criminal record or an eviction filing, right? So, in that regard, there's definitely a one up for self storage. However, I think like this concept of it being heavily management intensive is just not accurate. Again, it can be versus is. Now, I do heavier value add stuff. So a lot of my stuff is a lot more intensive because I'm chasing after that type of stuff. And just going across my own portfolio, the highest expense ratio I face with private utilities in the middle of the turnaround is about 45%. So in other words, every dollar that comes in, I'm spending 45 cents going out to fix in probably the worst case scenario. Best case scenario, I'm at about 25% on a really small property. So as that gets bigger and we raise rents, that'll in some cases go sub 20. So again, it comes back to can be versus is. Rent can be 100% automated. Late fees as well. People can pay online. People can cash pay at a Walmart. I don't have to touch anything. I actually can set up an auto text to let people know that they are late. So I don't actually have to do that. Again, the one big piece of this is I do and always will check my own applications myself and have employees do that. But again, the average tenant stays for 14 years. And in my experience, even with that really low turnover, the folks, generally speaking, sell to someone who's just going to take over rent. And if you look at P&Ls, it doesn't skip a beat. So vacancy loss is extraordinarily low for that reason. But again, it all comes back to this, can be versus is. And if you focus on mostly tenant-owned homes and you've got the right people in place, especially if it's direct build utilities, you're pretty much collecting rent. And then you're pretty much so just doing the right thing any investor should be doing, which is going to your property, talk to your residents, understand the people who are consuming your product. What do they like? What do they not like? How can you improve it? What other ways can you make money? That's what a business person does. And then not only that, you can bolt on acquire property. So one thing that I've done because I didn't have a lot of money is I'll buy like a 25 lot park and then something will happen. And then all of a sudden I know all the local folks and I bought a 60 lot park and then another 30 lot park. And for example, in Gaston County, right outside of Charlotte, I have 175 pads. Not one of those properties has more than 40 lots. So, and I have one employee for all of that. It's a pretty special thing, but again, it comes down to can be versus is. I have very sticky employees. I have very sticky residents. People, if they're not going to default on their home, because for most people, that's their most valuable asset. So, my time is spent mostly in rent week. And that's really it. Otherwise, the rest of the month, I work on my podcast. Like Scott mentioned, I coach because I want people to get into this space for the right reasons. And I want to echo everything Scott said. It was absolutely wonderful. So then I can focus on stuff like that, like my charity work. So, and then one other big piece of it is price inelasticity. Because we're so late in the game in terms of having artificial intelligence come in and actually in self-storage in a lot of cases, give you an optimal rent amount. This is like Billy Bob's mobile home park felt like the rent should be $200. Well, that's not necessarily the case. So the price inelasticity is very different in our space, which leaves a lot of upside and also allows you to bring in some awesome residents. Kevin?
Yeah, no, and I just want to start by saying that, you know, self-storage, mobile home parks, they're both wonderful asset classes, but it's not the only two ways to make money, right? You can make money in just about any asset class, right? So those that are watching, I think you've got to really focus in on which asset class is best aligned with you, your personality, your ultimate long-term goals, what have you. And it might not be either one of the two that we're talking about today. As far as the management side of mobile home parks, you know, Ryan, you hit on a point of the longevity of our average tenant, you know, 14 plus years. The beautiful thing about mobile home parks, that happens when something actually does turn. When we get a unit turn, we very rarely ever have any downtime, because what happens is that tenant puts their home up for sale. Maybe they have to move for a job relocation, or just maybe they're moving closer to a son or a daughter, what have you. They put their home up for sale, just like you would a stick-built home. They put that home up for sale. They continue paying that lot rent. New owner buys that property from them, assumes that lot rent responsibility. You don't have that, you know, that the week or two or month or two downtime when you're not receiving any revenue from that particular property. It literally is just seamless all the way through. It's an absolutely beautiful thing. In addition to that, with these tenant-owned homes, you find a very deep pride of ownership that exists. In fact, we have a number of communities that maybe not go as far as saying they self-police themselves, but they do, because these are literally homeowners that plant flowers outside their homes. They take care of their units. They look after their neighbors, and they view their community as a neighborhood. Go ahead. I'm getting cut off here, but it's very, very much akin to a coupon clipper type of investment. And again, a lot of the automations that you guys have, they do exist in our space as well.
You're good. We'll give the storage guys a little bit of extra time if they want it, and they want to.
Yeah, fair enough.
Mike, Scott, why don't you guys take us home with your rebuttal on the management piece here? I'm sorry. Sure. Management operations piece.
Yeah, just to rebut some of what Kevin was saying, I think a lot of it's true, right? That the part about the self-policing that he got cut short on there, I believe that to be true for tenant-owned homes. But what's happened here is our mobile home park guys have failed to mention the ugly duckling in their industry, and that is park-owned homes. And they are just a train wreck. I don't have experience in the mobile home park, so I'm going to speak to the stories I've heard from people who talk about speaking to Ryan's point about can be versus is, mobile homes can be awesome if you don't own a single one of the houses, but that's not possible. It can be, but not in the real world. Every owner I know, and I know some that own very big portfolios in the mobile home space, say that. It's just not realistic. So you're going to have that. So the point being here that while you may be able to do some automation on some parts of the mobile home park, that automation falls apart for a portion of the customers that they serve. And so, yes, storage and mobile home parks can both be automated, can be and is. Which asset class is automated with greater ease? I'm going to say that that's storage beyond a shadow of a doubt. One, because we don't have any park-owned units in our store or our storage facilities or facility-owned units, and we don't have any uncontrolled expenses. Right, those park-owned homes bring uncontrolled expenses. Sometimes utilities aren't metered the way that the park owners wish they could be. Right, the can be versus they can be separately metered, but they're often not, and sometimes it's very hard to get them separately metered. So, Scott, I'm going to turn the rest of our rebuttal over to you.
Sure. Yeah, our expenses in this, this is self-storage has been said that it's a very simple, predictable business model. It doesn't mean that it's a simple, easy business because none is. And if people treat it that way, they're going to find themselves in trouble. But it's a simple, predictable business model. You know, for buying Class C facilities, we know roughly what the averages are, nationwide averages, and then our own, that we know coming into a facility what we can expect, and we know where we can take it roughly. And, you know, that is one of the misnomers. I began looking into mobile home parks when I was making my transition out of homes and apartments. And I know some guys that were very big into mobile home parks over in Illinois. Ryan and Kevin, you probably know who I'm talking about, owned massive amounts of parks over there. And I went over on a fact-finding mission to see if this is something I wanted to do. And at the end of the day, there were so many unknowns. And this is when Conseco and the financing dried up for the financing of mobile homes. And yeah, then they became park-owned homes. And then it once again got me back into that place where it looked like I'd end up being a landlord and owning these homes and trying to finance them myself on some kind of rent-to-own. Whereas with self-storage, it's a metal box on a concrete slab. We buy it once, and when we need to turn it, we blow it out with a blower and move in the next person waiting in line. That's it.
Yep. Kevin, Ryan, why don't we wrap up round five here, and then I got something I want to share with everybody. So, guys, make sure you're tuned in. By the way, I appreciate everybody sticking through an hour and 45 minutes into this thing. We're going to be wrapping this thing up. Round five is not going to be quite as long as these, and I'm actually going to call an audible and switch it up a little bit. But, Ryan, Kevin, why don't you share your thoughts on the rebuttal when it comes to the management side?
Yeah, sure. Look, I have a lot of park-owned homes because I take mostly heavier value-add opportunities. Even still, less than 20% of my portfolio is park-owned homes. And even still, when you have back due maintenance, about 33% to 50% of the additional revenue that I get, and again, this is can be versus is because I only have data on that I trust that is my own. And so 33% to 50% of the rent I make above the lot rent itself on a park-owned home goes to the expense. So when it is done right, a park-owned home is an absolute wonderful thing to do. I run a bit of a hybrid model. You can also sell them off. You don't necessarily have to do rent-to-own. You can also partner with local construction workers. You do all sorts of stuff to ultimately make that a tenant-owned home. But it comes down to this. What strategy do you want? And I want to just second what Scott said earlier about having a mentor and educating yourself, because there's a lot of different ways you can go and you can really burn yourself no matter which of these two asset classes that you pick. Ideally, you're 100% tenant-owned home. Is that impossible? Absolutely not. I know plenty of folks who are effectively 100% park-owned home, or sorry, tenant-owned home. And occasionally, yeah, they will get a tenant-owned home back, but then they'll broker the sale and be done with it. So you are not beholden to park-owned homes. Can they be disasters? Yes, if you don't have infrastructure set up. But it's really, to be honest, not overly difficult to set up. It's actually pretty lucrative, spawning a lot of people who get into it just for the park-owned homes. Kevin?
Yeah, no, in our portfolio, it's made up of about 20% park-owned homes. So we do have quite a number. We have many communities where we have zero park-owned homes, and in others where we have more than that. But really, backing up here a little bit, I think a lot of it really comes down to your management ability and your ability to actually build a sound infrastructure, you know, hiring the right team members, you know, building the right team to oversee the management of these assets. I can tell you that although we have, you know, 200 plus park owned homes, it doesn't change how much effort on my side throws into the equation each and every week. So I'm not busier because we have 200 park owned homes versus having zero park owned homes. And as Ryan had mentioned, it's a very lucrative part of our business. In fact, we have a number of communities where we can ultimately mark up homes by 50%, and it's an additional profit center. So we can get cash buyers and literally make additional revenue streams by selling those park owned homes for a markup. So anyway, it looks like we're out of time.
That's all for this episode of the Flip Empire Show. But we have you covered with even more expertise and resources on our website. Text EMPIRE to 67076 or head over to flipempire.com to join the newsletter and gain free instant access to our video module training course called 5 Ways to Scale Your Real Estate Wholesaling Business to 6 Figures in 6 Months or Less. For more interviews, strategies, and insights for the smart real estate investor, we'll catch you next time here on the Flip Empire Show.